Welcome to the Digital Migration Podcast, initiative of the Line of Research on Migration and Digital Transformation of Nova Refugee Clinic Legal Clinic. Our group is composed by Inês Freires dos Santos,
Priscila Azevedo,
Sofia Salaiman,
Victoria Costa,
and Melinda Oliveira, and I have the honor of sharing this episode, which will feature two distinguished guests. Niovivo Vola, lecturer in migration and security at Queen Mary University of London School of Law, and Atina Sachulidou, assistant professor at Nova School of Law. Thank you both for having accepted our invitation and be here today with us. I'd like to start with a question to Niovi. Migration and technology, is this a recent relationship or an old partnership?
First of all, thank you so much for this very, very kind invite. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be with you today. Migration and technology, that is a very old partnership. For as long as digital technologies have developed, migration has always been one of the primary testing beds for new technologies. Political scientists have been long describing this relationship. For instance, has been saying how technology has been the mistress of politics, how the most contentious digital technologies, such as like fingerprinting, with generally biometry, or nowadays algorithmic profiling, and generally recourse to artificial intelligence tools, have been tested primarily and firstly on foreigners, on third country nationals, before being progressively tested to other groups or populations. This has been obviously because due to the weaker position of migrants and refugees who do not have much saying in this relationship with the state. And therefore, this relationship has been quite long-standing. For instance, since the 60s and 70s, the United States have been discussing how to harvest the PNR data at the time for law enforcement purposes. But we see that in the past couple of decades, in specific, digital technologies have been used all the more, and the more intrusive digital technologies, because there is not so much of resistance, one might say, on behalf of foreigners. So nowadays, it is a bit more intense and more visible because we have more generalized surveillance and more generalized use of digital technologies. But definitely, this is something that has been going on for quite a number of decades now.
Thank you very much. And I also have a question to Atina. When it comes to serious crime, does technological advancement definitely allows us to distinguish an ordinary citizen from a potentially serious criminal?
Thank you, Emeline. Allow me to say first that it is my pleasure to join you today for a podcast on such a topical issue and in such a good company. And of course, I'm referring to Niovi, who is a real expert on this topic. And actually, I only hope that I can offer some useful insights from a criminal law perspective. Back to your question, that is a really intriguing question. And I believe it can be subdivided into three different questions in real life. So, what does the term serious crime mean? And the truth is that there is no common understanding about its meaning, despite the fact that we see that term being used quite extensively, if you want, in both EU law, whether existing or draft, and in the case law of the European courts, among other things, as a part of the proportionality test for surveillance measures that are facilitated by means of technological advancements. And let us say that we are simply focusing on EU law, and we use Article 83 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the EU to orientate ourselves. I cannot really say that this is a perfect guidance. And why is that? Because it still remains problematic that some new offenses, like the ones that have been included in the EU terrorism legislation, often involve what many scholars call neutral acts, such as that of traveling. What is the second point that is being raised when I'm thinking of the question that you asked? Can technology be employed for the purposes of targeting, investigating, and eventually punishing what you call the potentially serious criminals? And this is where we need to distinguish between criminal law and police law. And in the realm of criminal law, no such category exists. So criminal law may indeed be concerned about the prevention of future crime, but originally it is designed to address past behaviors. In that sense, the focus should lie on those suspected of having committed a crime in the past or having already done so, and not on those presenting the potential to do so in the future, such as an immigrant that enters a country. Otherwise, I can see the line between punishing ideas and punishing actions becoming a very thin one. And it is against this backdrop that we cannot easily categorize what we call predictive policing. And speaking of the latter, it is also important, and that's actually the third point in your question. It's important to turn the spotlight on the so-called pattern-based data mining in terms of a model that is behind some predictive policing applications. And those do shift the focus onto non-suspect individuals to identify patterns of transactions, patterns of movements in case of refugees, patterns of behaviors in general that may correlate with suspicious activity. Those may actually target what you have called in your question potentially serious criminals, but they do so together with many innocent third parties. And the major question that arises here is, what are the rights of those persons when the police knock their door holding a risk report? And what is the status quo? Should the police never open an investigation if we do actually care about that status quo?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think you have started really well. So I come back to Niovi. Using technology, more specifically databases, to create profiles of third country nationals, would it somehow raise questions about the right to privacy and the protection of personal data?
Emeline, you have really touched a topic that is very, very close to my heart. I just finished my monograph on that. So if you want the full scoop of the answer to that question, you will have to wait a few more months before it is finally published, where especially I discuss the privacy challenges stemming from the operation reconfiguration of immigration databases. So immigration databases, to the uninitiated listener to this podcast, are six of them: Schengen Information System, Visa Information System, Eurodac, Entry Exit System, ETIAS, European Travel Information Authorization System, and ECRIS-TCN, European Criminal Record Information System for third country nationals. All these six information systems together, they will become interoperable, and all these together formulate what I have termed in the book a total surveillance of movement of nearly all categories of third country nationals with any administrative or criminal law link with the European Union. So these information systems target different groups themselves, but all together, if put together, they formulate a bigger puzzle of information systems, which basically target pretty much all third country nationals. Very, very few categories remain exempt at the moment, notably third country nationals with residence cards. These are the only ones who are missed at the moment of this bigger picture. And obviously, this setup of information systems pose numerous challenges, primarily to privacy and data protection, but not only to those rights. And the reason why we focus primarily on privacy and data protection is because the systematic collection, storage, and further processing personal data of third country nationals in information systems is considered in itself an interference with the right to private life and an interference with the right to data protection as enshrined in Article 7 and 8 of the Charter, respectively. So, this interference in many cases is disproportionate. And this is what I've argued in my book and in other publications. It is disproportionate in different respects. First of all, sometimes we see that from a procedural perspective, procedures have not been followed. There is lack of impact assessments. There is lack of evidence as to the necessity of setting up additional systems. The underlying rationale seems to have been that of expanding surveillance and filling perceived informational gaps. So the fact that there is no information centrally available to authorities for specific categories of third country nationals has been considered a gap which necessitates the intervention by the EU legislator. Apart from a lack of necessity, we also see a series of other problems. Sometimes we see that in specific cases, the personal data collected go beyond what is necessary. For instance, we see two categories of biometric identifiers collected, a full set of fingerprints, as if third country nationals are suspected of criminality by default, plus a facial image. And the facial image is collected in order to be used in the future with facial recognition technology. So these databases are also flexible and adaptable to new technologies that are yet to be implemented. We see that the retention periods of personal data are quite extensive. Sometimes they are not justified as to why a specific data retention period has been preferred. In the case of Eurodac, a 10-year retention period seems quite a long time. But also, one key problem that we have is law enforcement access to immigration databases. So by default, those groups of individuals, because of the systematic storage of their personal data in a database, it justifies their use also for another context, which is unrelated in reality to the administrative function of these databases. So law enforcement access, again, not always justified, poses specific challenges to protection of personal data and privacy. It is a violation of the so-called purpose limitation principle. Data should not be used for purposes which are incompatible with the original purpose. And sometimes we also see that the conditions under which the data may be used for law enforcement purposes are not of really high standards and are not in line with the case law of the Court of Justice of the EU in that respect. So we do have a number of problems. Also, these data are collected at the EU level, but under certain circumstances and primarily for the purposes of return, so for returning irregular migrants to their countries of origin, they can also be transferred outside the EU context to countries which may not offer really high privacy standards as high as those that the EU wants to say that they have. So we do see a multitude of problems relating to the operation of information systems, which will preoccupy in the future, I think, quite a lot.
Thank you very much. And Atina, talking about interference, in some Eastern European states, use is already made of lie detectors to check whether an applicant for asylum on the grounds of sexual orientation has a true factual basis. From the point of view of criminal law and criminal procedure, can questions be raised about the legality of using this equipment on asylum seekers?
Thank you very much, Emily. That's a truly interesting question, and it is worthy to know that it also fits very well into the existing literature, where some scholars argue that, well, when it comes to AI and machine learning as sources of evidence and tools that are employed for evidentiary purposes, those are not completely new in terms of the problems that they raise. On the contrary, they tend to be quite comparable to tools and technologies that belong in the past, including the early lie detectors that, of course, have been quite different compared to the ones that you referred to. In any case, when it comes to criminal law and criminal procedural law, those two will be concerned should the output of that tool, of that machine, let us call it the machine, be deployed for the purpose of initiating an investigation for a potential violation of the law that governs the asylum procedure. That amounts, of course, to a criminal offense. And if subsequently that output is considered admissible as an evidence before the respective criminal court. So it's not that the criminal law is concerned, and particularly criminal procedural law is concerned by default. And let us take this scenario. Let us imagine that we do have this piece appearing as evidence. So that would raise various issues ranging from the false positive rate, the rate of inaccurate assumptions, the quite well-known black box with regard to the model behind the machine, the indicators that the machine uses, the legality of the indicators themselves in case that they raise an issue of indirect discrimination, et cetera, the possibility that the affected individual has to contest the conclusion that is drawn by the lie detector. And this, of course, presupposes the much desired transparency and explainability, all those things that are pretty actively discussed in the scholarship. And when it comes to the heart of criminal procedure, those issues can be translated into implications for fundamental rights. And compared to the research that Niobe conducts, I do not focus on privacy that much. I rather focus on criminal procedural rights, including the right of fair trial, the right to defense, and of course the presumption of innocence. Of course, all of those go together at the end of the day. And just a reminder, since I do particularly focus on the presumption of innocence, the latter also encloses the so-called in dubio pro reo principle, meaning that at the end of the day, if there is any doubt, that doubt should benefit the vulnerable party. And in our case, that's the accused person.
Thank you very much. So I come back to Niobe with another question regarding her book, Surveillance and Privacy in Digital Age. When dealing with interoperability regulations, you argue that these regulations bring challenges to the principle of non-discrimination, the right to an effective remedy, and the right to seek asylum. Why have you highlighted these rights in a specific?
So thank you so much, Emeline, for this very good question on the co-edited volume with Valsamis Michilekas. In the article that I drafted, I focus on interoperability from a more holistic perspective, going a bit beyond privacy and data protection rights, which I believe that are still very much affected. The thing is that privacy and data protection, I consider them a bit, maybe a bit provocative to say, as like the gateway rights, like privacy and data protection. The primary rights that are first affected, but because there is no much expectation of privacy for third country nationals, then other rights are affected after privacy and data protection have been primarily first affected. So in this chapter, I discuss a bit the fundamental right challenges of interoperability to the right to an effective remedy, non-discrimination, and right to seek asylum. So with regard to non-discrimination, we see that interoperability poses very specific challenges which are magnified. The first one is the very notorious Article 20 of the interoperability regulations, which give the possibility to national police authorities to enable the use of one of the interoperability components, which is called the Common Identity Repository, in order to conduct checks on national territory to any person, any migrant, but also people who look like migrants, for instance. So the Common Identity Repository, to give you a brief overview, it's basically an index, like yellow pages, with the basic data of all third country nationals, which are included in all the underlying databases. So basically, police authorities are given the possibility under national law and following national rules to use the common, this index, and anyone that they see on the street that they may look like an irregular migrant, they may look suspicious enough to conduct a search using the Common Identity Repository. It has been held, and I completely agree with that, that this poses non-discrimination challenges because individuals may be targeted simply because they look like migrants, or they may be necessarily more affected if they undergo police checks on a very regular basis because there is a tool to search their data online and perhaps be harassed or perhaps be subject to degrading or discriminatory treatment. treatment. And in any case, it doesn't look good. And this is something that is not going to be regulated at the EU level, but it's just given the possibility to be regulated at national level. So one of the things is that. The second, that interoperability poses as a challenge to the principle of non-discrimination, has to do with another component, which is the European Search Portal. The portal basically is portal through which all databases will be searched at once, depending on access rights, obviously. So why this is a particularly contentious element of interoperability for non-discrimination, it's because this portal is going to enable automated searches on all information systems for the purposes of doing the pre-vetting for ETIAS, for getting a travel authorization, and also for doing the pre-vetting, like a pre-screening of visa applicants for the visa information system. So basically, applicants for travel authorizations and for visa applications, when they submit their application, their data are going to be automatically cross-checked against all other information systems, Europol databases, and some Interpol databases, plus certain algorithms which may pose discrimination concerns, as Athena mentioned earlier. And the European Search Portal basically facilitates this automated processing, and this automated processing may take place against discriminatory algorithms and screening rules that are going to be created by Frontex. So non-discrimination is being challenged through different standpoints. The right to an effective remedy is also very much affected, because when you have interoperable information systems and the third country national doesn't really know which database fed the data for a decision to be made for a third country national, it's more difficult to challenge that decision, because you don't really know how a decision on your stay or your deportation or on your entry has been made. Has it been made on the basis of CIS data? Has it been made on the basis of Eurodac data? Has it been because of Europol data? How has it been made? And because of that, and I resonate very much with what Athena was saying earlier, this poses challenges at the procedural level. How an individual can ask and seek effective remedies? Before which court? Is it the court that made the decision? What if the data come from a member state, which is a different member state? How to challenge a decision? And in order to challenge a decision, you need to have access to the data to know which member state has data on you and what type of data there is. And because there are such challenges on the right to effective remedy, this also may affect the chances of an individual to seek international protection. They may be affected from even having the possibility to enter the EU territory to apply for international protection in the first place. Database interoperability create barriers to individuals even getting access to the EU territory. And that has been the case before interoperability and will be the case also when interoperability becomes fully implemented. Individuals are going to see their data being used against them in the form of algorithms, in the form of previous contact of theirs, which then feeds decisions on them. And this will prevent their possibility to refugees to actually seek access, legal access, in order to apply for international protection.
Thank you very much. And also linked to your work, Athena, I would like to ask you, in your article published last year entitled European Transnationalism Between Success and Shortcomings, Threats, Strategies and Actors Under the Microscope, co-authored by Silvia D'Amato, you mentioned the need to analyze the functionality of the EU-centered transnationalism in the light of challenges such as transnational terrorism. Could you explain what this functionality of the EU consists of and how it relates to transnational crime?
Thank you, Emily, both for the question and for giving me the chance to introduce very briefly that publication, which is actually a special issue, is a collection of journal articles that has been edited by myself and Professor Silvia D'Amato from the University of Leiden. She has been my partner in crime since our times at the EUI in Florence. And that special issue is devoted on European transnationalism, as the title reveals, and seeks to achieve a twofold goal that I also believe that orientation addresses the first part of your question. So it aims at using the case of EU responses to transnational threats, ranging from the global health crisis to illegal migration, terrorism, et cetera, to signal the need for a renewed multidisciplinarity. And this is where our focus lies primarily on the relation between law and politics. And I think this is slightly related to what Niovi mentioned in her very first answer when she referred to the relationship between law and politics plus technology. And the second goal has been to explore those transnational challenges per se and understand what are their implications for the European apparatus as a whole and as a polity as well. So transnational or otherwise called cross-border crime, the example that you have selected, and this is where, of course, we have cybercrime appearing as one of the protagonists, is placed into this context. And my focus here lies, among other things, on the so-called electronic evidence proposal that the Commission has been working on for the past few years. We also had the LIBE committee from the European Parliament scrutinizing the proposal, suggesting not a contra proposal, but a compromise proposal on the matter. And well, I keep referring to a proposal. I had to explain what this proposal seeks to do. It's about facilitating the cross-border access to electronic information for law enforcement purposes. Or if you wish, it's another piece in the puzzle that Niovi has been describing earlier. And I do look at this proposal both in the context of this publication and another one that is published in the Global Affairs Journal from a fundamental rights lens. And guess what? Among other things, the lack of a common understanding about the meaning of serious crime appears to be once again of critical importance and at the center of both the attention and the criticism. And why is that? Because we are talking about quite intrusive investigatory means. I don't want to call them surveillance means, so to try to remain neutral. But anyway, we are talking about the European production and preservation orders that will allow access to a great amount of information, including both personal and non-personal data. And what we seek to do is, of course, to achieve proportionality and re-put the affected individual at the center of the attention, among other things, with regard to the right to an effective remedy that Niovi referred to earlier.
Thank you very much. So I'm sure that our members also have some questions to our guests. So I'd like to ask you, Sofia, do you have any questions?
Oh, yes. Hello, Niovi. I would like to ask you what needs to happen before we have the EU Big Brother. And I want to ask this because you mentioned the concept of the EU Big Brother in your article, The Puzzle of EU Large-Scale Information Systems for Third Country Nationals.
Thank you so much, Sofia, for this very interesting question. I don't mean to sound pessimist, but the deed has already been done. The databases have, the legal basis for setting up information systems have already been adopted. The latest was adopted in July. We are only awaiting for revisions to Eurodac at the moment, which have already been agreed upon. And interoperability is very much underway of development. So the EU Big Brother is already underway. So what can be done now in order to save face as European Union? What can be done, and I'm a very strong believer in strategic litigation, is to actually find a way that these information systems, which have completely evaded scrutiny by the Court of Justice on a fundamental rights basis, to actually make their way to the jurisprudence of the Court of Justice for the first time and be scrutinized as to whether they fulfill the principle of necessity and proportionality. So from my perspective, there is not much that can be done to change the legislation now, because we see that the more the legislation is changed, it actually changed to the worse. Only very few matters in relation to individual rights may be strengthened. But what can be done is actually try to seek to get the attention of the Court of Justice, which is a bit difficult because if third-country nationals are mostly preoccupied by other more eminent human rights needs. Privacy and data protection is a secondary afterthought when they realize, oh my God, I gave so much data, who is going to, where my data is going to end up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Niovi. Also, my name is Victoria. I have a question for Athena now. So in your article, Okay Google, Is She or He Guilty? You refer to intrusive surveillance when it comes to police investigations to collect prosecutorial material. How can we balance the need for surveillance, especially when it comes to digital tools, which can be used quite discreetly, and the respect for privacy? What are the criteria used to select which contents should be patrolled, and how does that play a role in criminal trials?
Thank you, Victoria. First of all, you see that I couldn't resist use the word surveillance after all in a written text. But anyway, this is a truly challenging question in terms of its breadth. As here, actually, we may talk about two different worlds that sometimes cross paths, but are not governed, or at least shouldn't be governed by the same rules. And that's something that also Niovi implied earlier. I'm referring to the world of national security vis-a-vis that of law enforcement, national law enforcement, on which my work focuses, coupled with that of criminal justice. So that is a world where national criminal procedural rules apply, coupled with the provisions inter alia of the European Convention on Human Rights, the EU Charter for Fundamental Rights, the Law Enforcement Directive and all the GDPR, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the context where I do look for the answers and the criteria you are asking me for. Although my focus lies, as I have already revealed, on the right to be presumed innocent, the presumption of innocence principle. So having said that, and while, to be honest with you, still looking for the right answer, I'm posing the question of whether we should consider the possibility of broadening the scope of some fundamental rights to the extent that those are actually challenged within a considerably larger context compared to the past. Among other reasons, due also to the fact that we do use digital tools that enable more intrusive investigatory measures. Now, as particularly regards the interplay between privacy, law enforcement, and selection of targets, if I understand correctly the last part of your question, I would like to very briefly refer to some case law that comes from the Netherlands and might be interesting for us. And I'm referring to a decision issued by the Hague District Court that provided us with some interesting views in the Siri case. So Siri has been a pattern-based data mining application that have been used by some Dutch public authorities in order to signal persons that may pose may be a high risk to commit fraud or other economic crimes. And the court, to make the whole story a bit shorter, may have avoided dealing expressly with the technology itself. For instance, it said that, well, I cannot tell if this is big data or not because we don't have any definition of big data. The court did not address the discrimination concerns that Niovi raised earlier, but it did rule that the laws that enable the use of a black box like Siri, because there was no disclosure of the risk model, of the risk parameters, etc. So the use of such an application for law enforcement purposes does not strike the fair balance that is required to justify an interference with private life within the meaning of Article 8, Paragraph 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And I think This is a good starting point at national level. The case law that Niovi mentioned earlier is another good starting point for starting fixing that criteria. And why I'm saying so, because unfortunately, the majority of the scholarship is still at a level where we perfectly describe the problem without providing any clear solution. And that's the next step for all of us.
Thank you very much.
So we also have a member called Inej Duissant. She could not make it today, but she sent a question to Niovi. How do you see or understand the European Union's current perspective on a digital citizenship as a form of European integration?
That's a very, very interesting question, which goes a bit beyond migration per se. Digital citizenship and generally integration on digital affairs and matters, we see that also with the proposal for an AI Act, Digital Market Act, Digital Services Act, everything goes and revolves around regulating modern technologies at EU level, is a quite interesting development in the past couple of decades. And it is interesting that it creates a level playing field, not only within the European Union, but also establishes the European Union as a global actor in data protection and privacy. And the so-called Brussels effect outside the EU context is very much known and well documented. And we've seen that with the GDPR. Now we see that a lot of attention globally is on the proposal for an AI Act. So it is a very important aspect of European integration, both within the EU, but also establishes the EU as an external actor globally. This has its perks, like the EU is developing standards that are then followed by countries that no one would imagine that they do, like Israel, Nigeria, I've heard recently, but also it has its flaws. Because on the one hand, it is good that member states have to abide by specific regulatory frameworks which have been subject to extensive consultation and negotiation. But because they are the subject of negotiation, they also have flaws because they reflect the views of to so many member states that have provided inputs. They have different cultures on privacy, on data protection, and on other human rights, and necessarily they carry these limitations because they are the subject of political compromise. So that's why it is important to promote integration in this field, but we also need to be aware of the limits of integration more generally.
Hi, here's Priscilla, and I have a question to Atina. In 2020, due to COVID, as an emergency measure, EU countries have established alternative methods to face-to-face interviews like asylum seekers, such as video conferencing and remote interviewing. Do you believe that such remote interviews would be sufficient to identify potential serious criminals and to avoid migrants to be smuggled? Or could it open space for another type of online transnational criminality?
Thank you very much. I think you caught me here. I'm not sure how much I can tell in case of this question, as I haven't really conducted any research on those topics. What I can say is that I have recently had a look. I have read about the enhanced use of technology and electronic tools for the conduct of asylum interviews and hearings in a report that has been published by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and I'm sure that you are probably aware of that report. And there it is actually stated that by those means, migrants may actually have a chance to regularize their situation instead of being blocked and waiting until all those measures, the restrictions are raised. And against this backdrop, they may abstain from relying on smuggling services, which unfortunately have not been diminished during the COVID-19 crisis. I cannot, however, make any straightforward claim about the possibility of identifying smugglers as such by means of those remote interviews. Irrespective of this, there is unfortunately, once again, some empirical data indicating that during the pandemic, trafficking activities have largely moved into the cyberspace, whereby the internet has been used to spread fake information, to recruit future victims, both for smuggling and human trafficking purposes. So in that sense, as regards the second part of your question, yes, there might be some space for another type of online transnational criminality. I don't know if Niovi has something to add here as he's the real expert on those matters, but I cannot give any more substantiated opinion on that.
Niovi, if you wanted to jump in the question also, you are much more than welcome.
I have also not conducted too much research on this topic, but my instinct says that it may be a bit difficult to see the nuances of someone's face, of someone's behavior, if they're smuggled or trafficked, when an interview is going to take place online. Perhaps a face-to-face interview may be a bit easier to see whether a person is in distress, whether they are under difficulties in that regard. So as far as I understand, because of COVID, things have gone a bit harsh on asylum seekers. They don't have that much access. It is more difficult for them to get international protection in the past couple of years. And COVID-19 has been abused by member states to prevent them, asylum seekers, from having their applications processed on time, etc. And I'm not entirely sure whether the digital aspect doesn't have any challenges to prevent individuals from being re-smuggled or being identified as victims of trafficking.
Oh, thank you very much. So I would say with these instincts and thoughts, we going to the end of the episode, but I will not finish without asking to our guests, Atina and Niovi, to say something about their current projects, because they work with so interesting projects and interesting people. So I'd like to ask you, Professor Atina, what are you working on right now?
Among other things, and for time's sake, I'm going to select the TRACE project, that is an EU-funded project that Nova School of Law is participating in, that is coordinated by the Coventry University in the UK. And when it comes to the purpose of this project, it's about developing AI-based solutions in order to detect illicit financial flows. And when it comes to my role in this context, except for studying cross-border cases of financial criminality, is to scrutinize the solutions that will be developed from the technical partners from both an ethical view and a legal perspective. And my focus lies particularly on data protection and criminal procedural rights that I mentioned before. And I have the pleasure to collaborate with another organization that is based in the UK in this specific context, and that is Trilateral Research. And yeah, I hope that you're going to have some news on our part very, very soon.
Thank you very much. And Professor Niovi, who abandoned us here in Europe, what happened?
Actually, I am not in Europe anyway, because I'm based in the United Kingdom, which nowadays it's outside the European Union, so still Europe. But at the time, I am on sabbatical leave, and you find me in Washington, D.C. As a visiting scholar at George Washington University, also affiliated with the Center for Artificial Intelligence and Digital Policy. And I will be working, and it will not be a surprise, on artificial intelligence in immigration control. I will be here for a few months, after which period I'm going as a visiting scholar to the European University Institute. So a lot more exciting challenges to immigration law are going to be posed by the growing recourse to a quite contested artificial intelligence systems.
Thank you very much. So we come to the end of our episode. Thanks again for the brilliant, insightful participation of our guests, Atina and Niovi. Thank you very much. To our followers, Thank you for listening and stay tuned for the upcoming episodes of our podcast and initiatives of our research line that you can find on social media and on our website of Nova Refugee Clinic, Legal Clinic. See you in the next episode. Thank you very much.